Also, we are having a meeting tonight. The caucus is having a meeting tonight, so please, you are invited. Sorry for the plug. The next two presenters, we have Sandra Amuchi, Dr. Sandra Amuchi, who is a sociologist, and she began working in public health in her postdoc period, designing statewide interventions to address environmental health of children in California. She has 15 years experience, and she works as an evaluator in public health programs, mostly primary and secondary prevention programs in California, which is part of the Pacific Northwest. We also have Patricia Irwin, Dr. Patricia Irwin, who is director of San Francisco's Department of Public Health. The program is called Newcomers Health Program. As you know, Newcomers Health Program, so I don't need to tell you what that is about. And she works on a variety of projects and services for new refugee immigrants in San Francisco. She also serves as a health education consultant for the California Refugee Health Program. Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Sandra.
Well, congratulations for getting up and coming out here so early this morning. And I have to say, I'm very delighted at the order of the presentations because I feel very stimulated by what I heard this morning. And I do hope that we have some time. I won't take too long to actually engage in some dialogue. Patricia and I both got in the ground floor in California of designing a program to address chronic health conditions of our refugees. And I just want to share, among all the things we could speak to you about today, we were forced to whittle down to a few key learning objectives. And so we're going to focus a little bit on, we're going to take this this whole presentation to a different level here. We're going to really talk about systems, statewide public health systems and local public health department and their role in basically addressing chronic health issues of California's refugees. And so we're going to try to focus a little bit on what a state can do with their incoming refugees regarding chronic health. Since we were involved, Patricia mostly, in the design of the statewide program and me in the evaluation of it, we're going to talk a little bit about the critical features of designing such a program and evaluating it. So the first thing I'd like to start with in this is what is our challenge? And I feel well set up to describe that by the two presenters before me. Our challenge in California is how can a state such as California and county health, local health departments assist refugees in becoming and staying healthy through prevention, early detection, and the management of chronic diseases. Our state, and I'm not too sure about this because I don't actually hail from public health, but we have a comprehensive assessment, a health assessment process that our refugees undergo, and I think its origin in locus of original concern had a lot more to do with prevention of communicable diseases among refugees. And insofar as we have assessed their health on other dimensions, we've become concerned about chronic health conditions. For all the reasons that we know about the condition of refugees coming from souls and extremists in other parts of the world, what they bring with them, it's no surprise that they have a higher risk factor for all kinds of chronic diseases. And as a public health system, we felt it was important to try and give them some help in addressing those things. So just to give you a little context, in the last 3 years, these are the top refugee groups in California, which is an interesting contrast to Massachusetts. And only recently, really, have we seen Iraqi refugees, although, as you can see here, they're in fairly large numbers, not surprisingly, due to the war. I was surprised that the Iranian refugees are the highest refugee group in California in the last 3 years, and it really wasn't that long ago that most of our refugees came from the former Soviet Union. But, you know, they still are coming, not at such a high level. I'm predicting that we'll probably have more refugees from Afghanistan in the next few years. Just to put this in context a little bit, though, this is the top 15 refugee groups that make up the majority of the refugees that come to California. And when we get past the top 15, the numbers are so small that it's hard to describe the countries. But in terms of the number of refugees and the overall population of California, you see here that we have, in 3 years, 18,357 refugees, and in 1 year, a population of 37 million people. So it's a small fraction of the California population that are refugees. So what do they come with other than communicable diseases? And we do still have some people who are being treated for latent tuberculosis and tuberculosis, but mostly they come with dental problems. And I don't know, Patricia, maybe you can help me understand this. Do other states do comprehensive assessments like California?
It varies greatly okay. across the country.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky that we have some data on this then, because we can see that this is pretty consistent over the term of our work with the refugees that, and I guess it isn't surprising either, you know, that dental health, I mean, how many people who are U.S. citizens, when their health insurance falters or they can't, you know, afford the copayments, forego dental care first, and under the conditions that people arrive here, that's the one of the most evident problems. But then the second two, essential primary hypertension and obesity, and you can see that in the last year, obesity has overtaken essential primary hypertension. Absolutely not surprising that people who come with refugee status have hypertension, which, of course, if it's uncorrected, not treated, if they don't know about it, it's likely to evolve into some form or another of some kind of, you know, cardiovascular problem. And obesity, if they're coming in with obesity and they're coming into a country that has the highest rate of obesity, we know that that's a clear setup for a problem. So we've been focusing a lot on essential primary hypertension and obesity with our refugees. So we set ourselves out to, the state has developed an intervention that's statewide, and it's a 5-year intervention, and its primary goal is to promote the overall well-being, change the behaviors related to healthy living, and improve self-management of cardiovascular risk factors related to chronic health conditions for the refugees in California. And so California itself is a diverse state with many different ecosystems, political cultures, north to south to central. And as you can see, we have a tremendous variety in the refugee groups that are settling in California. So developing a statewide system to address chronic health through all these different systems and substrate of institutional structures, taking into account that we need to also work with people from the refugee groups as health promoters, or this wouldn't work at all. It's no simple task. So Patricia's going to take the next few slides and tell you a little bit about the mechanics of the design of the intervention.
Thanks, Sandra. And just to explain a little bit on those top conditions we were identifying, that is in the very first two visits. So there's a lot of issues. I mean, a lot was talked about earlier on mental health and other health conditions that come up longer term that are harder to identify initially when people first come in. But these are things that we're seeing because these counties are funded just for two visits to work with people. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that and how we're working with those systems to provide this long-term behavior change, which is challenging. So in terms of the role of the state, the California Department of Public Health Refugee Health Program is basically providing the overall leadership. Besides coming up with the program, they identified subcontractors. And as Sandra said, this is statewide, but in fact, it's only operating in 8 counties in California. I think there's 12 or 13 counties in the state that are funded, and 8 of them are funded to do the health assessments, and then 8 of them are doing this long-term chronic disease program. So, however, these counties are the ones I'd say probably these eight counties see about 80% of the refugees in California. So we are capturing most of them. So we had to identify which were these larger counties and were they willing to take on this kind of different project that is looking at people longer term. And then to support them in developing methods, again, to look at people long term. So it's not just this like, LTBI is relatively so simple. They're diagnosed with a PPD, they go to a chest x-ray, send them to the TB clinic. You know, it's like shorter term, easier to manage. This is something where these counties were going to be expected to figure out systems to work with people longer term and really get them linked into ongoing health care. So the role of the state was to really support them in developing systems that work locally, taking into account some statewide systems. And also to provide ongoing technical assistance, both in implementing the program and evaluation, and that's where Sandra's role comes in, and mine is more in the program implementation. And then in developing trainings, because we recognized right away that a lot of the healthcare providers in refugee health assessment are not as used to working in long-term chronic care management. And we also wanted to look, as Sandra was saying, at developing some train-the-trainer models for working with community health workers from the community who could support these refugees and the clinics in this long-term strategy for chronic disease management. So in terms of the local entities, there are seven county health departments and one VOLAG, which is a refugee resettlement agency. And they have three key roles. One is to implement these infrastructure systems that I was talking about that were designed locally but with statewide support and with the real idea of improving, first of all, the identification. So as many of you probably know, it takes a while to identify some of these conditions, the chronic diseases, not so much obesity or hypertension, which is probably one reason we see it more here. But pre-diabetes, diabetes, these take longer. So really to figure out is there somebody that we need to keep watching and bring them back and so that we really can diagnose them and make sure they get the support they need. And then following up with those refugees. So this is actually the implementation. Another key role is to work more closely long-term with these refugee community-based organizations to help in delivering health education and so that they understand these models about healthy lifestyle and healthy living as well and maybe could partner with the county health departments in providing these messages to the new arrivals. And then to, as I was saying before, recruit, train, and support refugee community health workers. So in terms of the infrastructure systems, this is, we feel like the crux of what we're really trying to do statewide, because if we can develop some systems locally that can help identify these conditions and get people linked into long-term care for their condition, then we have a chance to really make a difference, as opposed to like a one-time, okay, I'm just going to identify the one or two communicable diseases, treat that, and then we're done, and they move on. So this is really the crux of what we're trying to do, and it's also one of the most challenging things, I think, in terms of, again, because these counties are often used to looking at these two visits, and then we're done, and to really looking at these longer-term systems. It's a shift. It's a big shift for counties who have been doing the same type of thing for 30 years in some cases. So one of the important considerations are, and this is true across health in general, but how well acquainted are the clinic staff with the culture and customs? And I think it's really important, the sociocultural health beliefs and practices that Anaï was talking about. It's even more important with long-term strategies than short-term one-time treatment. You may still have challenges with communities where they say yes, 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 and then they don't take their medication. But when you're really looking at trying to change behavior and long-term, possibly long-term treatment, you really have to have an understanding of people's backgrounds, issues, and health practices, and the link to traditional healing or other kinds of systems that they may have, and how does that all tie in together? And also, how can we stress the importance of self-management, et cetera, when these newly arriving refugees have so much going on? It's hard enough to get them to come to one visit just for the immunizations that they might need, that their kids need to go to school, let alone long-term care. So these are really, we don't have all the answers, but they're things that we're grappling with as we implement. One thing we forgot to mention, actually, we just finished the second year of implementation. We had 1 year of planning, and we have 4 years of implementation. So we're about halfway into the implementation, and things are smoothing out as we go along. So one thing that we did, as I mentioned before, is we developed a training for the refugee healthcare providers, the ones who do the health assessments, to give them an understanding of what are these top health conditions that we're seeing statewide and in the counties, and what are some systems that have been developed by primary care providers to work with patients who are identified with chronic health conditions. And then, how does that apply to the refugees in your community and the sociocultural issues and the experiences that they have had? And then also, as I was mentioning, the use of community health workers from refugee communities. In some cases, these are paid staff members. They might be volunteers. They might be students. And they are from the community. And the idea is that they provide support to the refugee communities in behavior change and then generally increase community awareness. There was a story that we heard of somebody from Mongolia that was a young man who felt healthy. He looked healthy. He came in complaining of ongoing headaches for a long time. He hadn't seen a doctor in many years. He was an asylee, so he had been in the U.S., no health access to health care, finally got his asylum, and he came to the clinic. He was diagnosed with prediabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol. He got linked into this long-term care system with primary care providers, working with this community health worker as the liaison, a triangle really, not a one-on-one between provider and patient, but really a triangle so the provider understands the patient's issues, the patient understands the provider, and then the health coach, the health worker is really working with both of them to come up with systems that are going to work mutually. So a year later, his hypertension and his high cholesterol are under control. He has a good job, and he's, you know, integrating into a good life here. And if that had not been, you know, diagnosed, he could have gone on long term. And who knows what would have developed. So that's just a story of how I think without that health worker in the triangle, the success might not have been the same a year later. Another important issue that we continue to grapple with is the different systems and the ways that each county is structured. And the first speaker was talking about how how everywhere is so different. And some of the counties in California, the refugee health program is linked directly with primary care, much simpler system to work with. In more of the cases, the refugee health program is kind of just a separate thing that's like a screening identification, and then they have to link them into primary care. That's a much more challenging system, both for the refugees, the primary care providers, and especially when you take into consideration chronic health conditions. So this next slide just talks a little bit more in depth about that. But the real challenge is linking between the refugee health screening program and the identified conditions to these primary health care providers, information flow back and forth, and how to share that. 2 minutes, okay. So I am going to move along because Sandra has some things. So this is just a little bit more on how we were setting up some models to improve the coordination. And again, it's these infrastructure systems trying to, you know, we all have HIPAA to consider sharing of the information back and forth, and then integrating these health coaches to support these refugees longer term. And so Sandra is going to talk about the evaluation now. Thank you.
I feel like we're just skittering on the surface of a wide sea here. So my challenge really was to try and develop an evaluation that would capture two levels of thing. One, we were trying to look statewide at what kind of changes are happening in people's lives and measure them one you know, county against another, one grantee, how are they doing on the things that we want them to do? And the second was, how do we do an evaluation that captures the individual differences and sort of institutional culture, if you will, of the different health departments? And so I elected to do a standard evaluation where I developed a survey that is administered to all the refugees who get health education, and they all get it at some level, some just with the first encounter with the primary care physician or even the assessment physician, and some, like the program that we have in San Francisco and San Diego, at the end of an 8-week series of health education on chronic disease. And that survey is translated into, 10 different languages. And, you know, even in some instances, we have people that aren't like the Hmong, when we started in Fresno, they're not literate in any language, in their own language, and so it had to be administered, you know, with some sensitivity through an interview process. And we asked questions about, you know, how do you really evaluate a primary and secondary prevention program when you have no access to data on long-term outcomes? So we try to do proximal indicators having to do with behavior change, eat more healthfully, fruits and vegetables on a weekly basis, get more exercise, and manage stress, which is a huge one for refugees. Do they have a repertoire of replacement activities for smoking and overeating and things like that? So we measure at the end of the health education or intervention that for all the refugees, and we're starting to get some data now, and it looks pretty good. They all make individual plans, action plans, and depending on what in their culture they call it, with through these different local agencies, so they're culturally specific to the refugee groups. They make plans to follow based on their primary presenting problems related to chronic health, and then they follow those. For the institutional level, we have we started off by giving all the programs objectives that we wanted to accomplish with this. They get grant funds from the state. One example of those objectives, by the end of the 5 years, 100% of the refugees identified with chronic conditions will be linked to a primary care physician, and 70% will be followed up to see that they make the appointment and that they get some kind of care to address their chronic health conditions. I just talked about that. So the evaluation data so far is basically, it's enabling us to see that it has been a very slow process to get the infrastructure change, to get systems of follow-up and linking people to primary care physicians. The people that are now primary care physicians for the refugees have all been involved in some kind of training about the refugee group. Sometimes, when you're lucky, the primary care physician is from the group itself, but that has been the case with some refugee groups and not with others. We don't have a lot of primary care physicians who are Iraqi, for example. So they need to be somehow trained about what the Iraqis, you know, what their situation is, what their, you know, how to work with them. And in some cases, like Patricia described, you know, you'll have a health worker in every medical encounter to be interpreter, bi-directional interpreter in that encounter. That system has been slow to get set up because we're talking about a huge state and a lot of people, but we do now have it for all the grantees. There's some system of tracking and follow-up, linking people to primary care physician, helping people develop plans to address their chronic health conditions. And then it varies a lot. In some counties, we do have extensive work with local community agencies to help them on an ongoing basis with their health issues, and in some counties, not so much. But in all cases where they have a health education around the chronic disease, we are seeing some real improvement in the proximal measures of behavior change and setting out to adopt a plan to address their chronic health problems. So we feel that it's a promising model. It's going to be interesting to see how many people in the long run after the 5 years we can affect and where we can take it. Thank you.
Let's give them a big sign of applause, all the presenters. I'll open up the floor now for discussion or a question. Any question? And you can ask any presenter. Okay, let's go ahead. Patricia, you can come over here and speak when
Okay, so the question was, how do we identify, train, and fund the community health workers? So basically, that's, in terms of the training, the state hired a training consultant who put together a binder with a lot of materials in it. There's a lot of practical exercises and ways that people are work together in pairs or with small groups to come up with action plans, to do some motivational interviewing, understand basic health education and the stages of change, etc. So it's quite a large binder, and then they held a training, and every county came who's funded. They sent a few people. The idea was to train the trainer. So everybody had at least one person who hopefully is still on staff and can then be training locally. And in some cases, they were able to send actually a couple of community health workers themselves. In terms of the identification and the funding, that's up to the counties locally to determine. Some of them, I mean, one thing, they already, in many cases, they already have some link to community health workers because they're interpreters or et cetera. They know who the community is, so I think that they're doing recruitment. I know what we're doing in San Francisco is we're doing recruitment through our patients, basically, you know, offering these stipended volunteer positions. And also, we have trained our staff to be, you know, using this same model. So it's a different role for them than just being an interpreter and taking health history. It's this, you know, health education strategy. The funding is, if they are, you know, we actually give stipends or they're paid staff. It depends on their role. So we give, you know, the counties their option to do that. It is challenging, though. Some of the counties really have challenges because of their bureaucracies to actually give a stipend or to hire. I mean, everybody has identified some people, but I think not everybody has identified as many individuals as they would like, you know.
Had to fund it out of their own county public health department funds, or were they awarded funds from the state?
They're awarded funds from the state. All these counties are getting grant funds from the state, so they can use some of these grant funds to pay these community health workers.
And how many years will it be for?
It's 5 years total. Right. That's why there's such a focus on the systems. I mean, the infrastructure to try to see if at least they can have something that would be sustainable in terms of the identification and linking to primary care. You know, I don't feel like I can really respond to that very knowledgeably. We could look into it more, but I know, for example, Iraqis, which is, even in the past 3 years, it's our second largest population, they are coming with a lot of health conditions. I think it's the lifestyle they live, the food that they eat. I mean, it's very common. But I can't speak to it specifically. And I think the other issue is a lot of the foods that people eat in the refugee, I mean, for people who are actually in the refugee camps, is a Iraqis are a little bit different in terms of their situation. I mean, they've fled and then they're coming, but they're not necessarily in a camp. But a lot of the people have been in camps, I mean, the Burmese, the Bhutanese, for decades. And I think they've just had really like a lot of access to poor quality foods.
The example that we export from
A new thing to look into. Right, and I think they talk, you know, the foods, I mean, even if it's not junk food like potato chips, but the cheeses and the processed food that is being exported to feed refugees in camps and other displaced people is not the best nutritional food, yeah.
Another question?
Patricia? To Anahi. Okay, Anahi, can you please come to the mic?
I was wondering what the training was of the people in these health centers.
Hi, your name?
Kathy. What the training is of the people in these centers.
Oh, great, it's a great point. And I really refer to it very superficially. One of the issues was for us to, when we had the survey and the semi-structural interview, we had the primary healing practice and secondary and tertiary. Most of them call themselves spiritual counselors, because then when we call, I will remember the flyer that stated, are you a healer? No. But many of them, and that's the other fascinating thing about doing this in New York, is that they become global healers. And one of the healers will say, the more knowledge you have of different healing practices, from use of herbs, Santeria, most of them were trained in one of the Caribbean related religions. Typically in New York, those are Santeria from Cuba, Palo Mayombe from the 21 divisions from Dominican Republic, Mezcalanda, which means white table, Espiritismo in Puerto Rico, but they do practice many related, and they actually said that they have such a variety of customers that they adapt to whatever is needed. They do tarot readings, they do a lot of what they call voodoo from the, you know, Africa, but actually they are very adamant related to the fact that they practice white magic, no black magic, because of all the, what I said at the beginning, the bad reputation that Santeria has, all these rituals. The other thing I didn't mention is a lot of collective healing. I don't have time to talk about it, but I'll give you a little example. A woman was raped. She comes to the consultation, and this Santeria says, we couldn't treat her because of all the post-traumatic rape symptoms. We had to do collective healing. The idea that with all the women who had not been raped but also had been victims of abuse, this is not very different to what we do in the psychological model when we have peer support systems. They don't call it that way. They call it collective spiritual healing and so on and so forth. And the other thing I was actually participant on, it was the Santeria rituals, where, you know, you have seen the drumming. I don't want to talk about it because I'm not an expert and I feel like I'm really minimizing the importance of this. But those gatherings have emotional purposes, religious purposes. People do ceremonies for initiation and advancement within the religion, but also for healing.
Yeah, but yeah. My question is, how do they get credibility in the community?
Okay. No. You have to follow one of the religions, and they get, and again, there are different routes. If you are just a client, it's somebody who can undo the damage that somebody has done on you. But it's within the community, there is a very structured hierarchy, and some healers have more reputation. They fight for customers, not very different from what happened in the biomedical model. The reputation is based on clientele, oral reproduction. They don't advertise. What you see in the advertisement is not real stuff. It's oral tradition for the most part. And very interesting, In another publication, we talk about the parallel power structure. A few of these healers were actually literate. So entering the religion allows them to gain a kind of prestige and power that they wouldn't have in normal lives. It's religious healing for the most part. I don't want to generalize because we almost interviewed 60 healers and they were, and I give you an example, very short. There was this psychologist, undocumented from Uruguay, another spiritual counselor. She couldn't practice because she was undocumented, she couldn't upgrade her degree. She was doing a spiritual healer and she would say, of course I use praise, of course I use mantras, but the truth is I'm doing counseling, the same I used to do, but I cannot call it that in this country. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Yeah, you're talking, I think, a little bit about a parallel system to the medical clinical model of providing care for immigrants and refugees. Do you see any interface between faith healing and healing practices and clinical practice? And for example, are you thinking, is your research at all oriented toward educating physicians about this?
Yeah, we do actually. Yeah, we actually train not physicians, mental health practitioners, because actually these practitioners serve the population that uses the healer's practices. And a typical example is oír voces, to hearing somebody else talking. So typically in the clinical practice, somebody who hears voices, Gonzalo, how do you diagnose somebody clinically who hears voices? Psychotic. And these people believe that no, they are not crazy, they're just listening to somebody else, a dead relative or a soul that is, and I was talking to them, somebody said, be quiet because they are telling me something about you. Okay. You know, so you have to incorporate, and the reason why actually they invite me to give these talks, something very similar, and I talk about what it means, some of the diagnosis, and what it means for the healers, because the more clinicians understand this alternative mode of healing, the more they're able to help them. If you give somebody a medicine to stop the voices, and that person doesn't want to stop the voices because they're actually giving her or him good information, she's going home, not taking the medicine, and saying, this doctor doesn't work. It's useful for me to get the welfare receipt, but it's not doing any good to me. So that's why, actually, I have to say, they are very open-minded, the clinicians, because they need help to. I'm not saying I'm an expert, I'm just sharing with them what I learned, what we learned. We are a team healing.
Did they refer them to the traditional medical
models? No. No. That's the big, it's too much, and also, still we're far away from really bringing, I believe, these two different models into a real understanding of each other, goods and bads. Thank you. I think there are more questions.
Yeah, to contribute to, I'm from Ghana originally, and we have these practice systems, and we've had this over hundreds of years before Europeans came in. We have traditional healers who heal. Even to the current day, we still have traditional healers. To the extent that we have something called man, that's a human being. Man heals, God cures. Okay? And what happens is that even when people are sick, they still go to see the traditional healer, and then they still go to see the Western biomedical system. Sometimes when they go to Western biomedical systems and the condition is not being cured, they go to the healers and it is cured. So sometimes they say that the disease is not a Western, sickness. It's rather spiritual and so on. So I can see a lot of parallels and interconnections, and I'm not surprised because people from the Caribbean and other Latin American countries, some came from Africa, so they brought their religious practices with them. Question?
Okay.
One of the problems, though, with a lot of this thing is that it is a business, so
we've
got to be very careful with the, sort of like making it, mystifying this for healing as so great, because I did a study
several years ago, in which we got some help from some of the boticas and in terms of doing focus groups there because people will arrive. And clearly, you know, there's some of these folks are really just to make the money, so they set up business, and so we have to be very careful that not all what goes on there is so great. And they, you know, so and so it's, there's this, yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. So yeah, one of the things that the point I wanted to make is how we can set it up so actually the refugees have some voice in this. I mean, this is one of the biggest. This is like the work with homeless people. How do these folks actually have a voice on the table? Because we tend to think of the medical or the PH, I mean, public health people, the council, whatever. But where do these refugees have some sort of a voice? Because otherwise, you know, we go to these quote folk healings who are supposed to represent these communities, but often these folk healers are just representing themselves in the same way that a lot of professionals are just making a buck, you know. So there is a piece that that is not there. So in the folk healing, sometimes there is a lot of power and control that is very strong too, you know. Correct, and it's not only out of pocket, but sometimes they establish relationships that are of a lot of dependence, so they may not charge you, but then you have a sort of like a, and some folk healers actually are connected with some of the traffic. So there are great folk healers who are connected to, I mean, you have both. And so you have to be aware of this sort of like interesting dependence connection also. But on the other hand, so that's why we have to, I'm advocating that we need to figure out how we work with the people who are arriving into this, putting them on the table. I mean, how do we put them in the, how do we think of them as being part of the board of directors, so to speak, rather than just the people who are going to be serving? Right, and a lot of refugees are professionals like us.
Yeah.
And so you have, you know, huge levels of ability there too. And so, you know, in this scope of this, you know, chronic illness and, you know, mental health and et cetera, one of the big problems, and this is why I think a lot of the services are very still very, quote, progressive human rights, but still pretty damn condescending, not on the level of horizontal relationships with these folks who are like us, let's face it.
I have a question for you. Yeah, I have a question for you.
But in Iraq and Iran, do they also have traditional drugs?
Yeah.
I think it's more prevalent in
Iraq.
There's a paper I've passed around for those who want to join our caucus. The paper is still going around. Please fill it. Also a reminder that we are having a meeting tonight, 6:30, in this building. I have a question for... In C. Commonwealth C. Thanks, Ike. I have a question for Dr. Gonzalo. Why do people move to those countries you mentioned, and why to some states in particular? I know that sometimes the government decides that people should move to Idaho or they should move to North Dakota to populate those areas. But do you have any reason why people choose to go to those particular countries or to those states. And I'm really surprised that refugees go to other countries rather than the United States, because when you listen to the news, the conservatives are always complaining that we are taking so many refugees, only to realize that we take very little compared to what we do. Thank you. Or compared to our economic strength.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on where refugees go, but I mean, refugees don't choose where they go. They're refugees who really are put on a plane and they're not even known the plane where they're going. And some of the Iraqi refugees, they thought they were landing in France and they're landing in Boston. Honest. Just 3 months ago, some of my students went to, we have the students do the whole thing about so that they know how it works for the refugees. It's and how, you know, the whole day, there's financial help to do the 1 day and the 3 day thing. So that there's a 1 day in which they're a company and they found a place and et cetera. And some people, you know, they were saying, why are all the signs in English? So people were arriving, they did all the processing in immigration, and they're still thinking why all the signs and everybody's speaking in English. They thought they were arriving in a Francophone country until they were explained that they were in the United States. So, and some of these people were taking French lessons in the refugee camp. So it's not like there's a choice. And a lot of places where there's huge amount, millions of refugees, like in Pakistan, I mean, they're being pushed there. I don't know if they're refugees. They're basically displaced. They have the legal status of refugees, but they're not really.
And I think within the United States, they don't have a choice either, because
within the United States, they don't have a choice.
They're getting assigned, and it depends
right
on which refugee
settlement agency.
Exactly. Certain refugees. So then they
Right.
But in really, as far as I know, when they decide to go there, as opposed to New York.
Correct. Correct.
I think we've come to the end of our session, and thank you all so much for coming, and let's give you all a round of applause. If you have any question, you can talk to any of the presenters. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate this. Bye-bye.
And I will be here then the session afterwards.